You got that? There are more of them back here. You want to take some along?
No, what am I going to do to keep you from tripping over this? Shall I put it on the other side? Are you adept at playing jump rope while you're not sure?
Playing putting.
Hey, maybe one.
Part of the physical rehabilitation.
Well, I guess I'm ready to go to work. You people are. I would like to introduce you this morning to what one might call jurisprudence, as the wisdom of the law. By trying to explain something about the way in which law functions and something about its sources. Tomorrow morning I would like to illustrate that by talking about family structure as a legal problem. Friday morning, our third meeting together, I don't know what I want to talk about because that depends upon how you react today and tomorrow. Last night when we were talking about the Powell case, you may remember that Mr. Justice Black, in his opinion, said that it would be an absurd thing to punish a man for something that he thought, that it is tolerable only to punish a man for his actions, not for his thoughts. It would be an absurd thing to have a body of law which would punish or hold criminal simply intellectual processes as distinguished from action. I mention this to you now simply to, first of all, underline what I see myself as a major theological hyphen legal problem that we seem to have a tremendous amount of difficulty with. Because if you will remember your scripture, where we are told that you may say as a legal proposition that a man is not guilty, for example, of adultery until he commits adultery, but I say unto you that a man who simply looks and thinks is already in violation. And here you see is a basic underlying principle that you simply dare not overlook. One is, as the whole opinion last night, the whole Powell decision, as well as Robinson, stresses again and again and again, you must wrestle with this concept of the difference between being something. It is what you are. It's a matter of status. This is what Isaiah calls sin, to be totally alienated, to be separated. And that is sin. There is such a thing as a conversion. A conversion is to transform a human being from an alienated person to a adopted or a reunited status in God. The stuff that Paul talks about in his letter to the Romans and other places, of course, throughout the New Testament, where we talk about sins in the plural rather than sin like this, are really misdemeanors or felonies or gross misdemeanors. They are a violation of law. This is reiki you're getting now. Don't blame Paul for it. However, I believe that Paul also says that even as sin, S-I-N, capital, singular, alienation, preceded law, did not come as a result of it. So these things that we call sins in the plural with a little s, different word in Scripture, are talking about misdemeanors or felonies, misbehavior of a kind that we find to be socially disuseful, unuseful, harmful to our organization. So judges like Marshall and Black and the other people who write these opinions that we were looking at last night talk again and again about, quote, moral problems. And you've got to wrestle with that concept of morality in this context. What do you mean by morality? I know what I mean by morality. When I talk about morality, I mean a violation of a law, of a rule. Something, maybe it's the golden rule, but the golden rule is still a rule. It's still law. And when you violate it, you are doing something which is not useful to our coordinated life together. You are not talking about sin. Some of a very helpful discussion that we had over in Koinonia the other morning about the lifestyle. The lifestyle is either in or out of Christ. and one's activities are apt to follow his lifestyle. I'm almost through with the prologue now, and then I'll get down to jurisprudence. I do want you to see that Christ was, in Paul's little s sense, a gross sinner. The sinless Christ was a violator of the law on numerous occasions. And if you are going to insist upon mixing the moral hyphen legal with the moral hyphen spiritual, then you must be very careful, because you no longer have a sinless Christ, he who violated the Sabbath ordinances and so forth. All right, I leave that for you now to think about as we try and talk about the relationship that I as a lawyer must wrestle with when I talk about law and gospel. Law is a system. It is built up primarily of two things. One, rules. Two, problems. Almost every law student that I teach, almost every law student with whom I meet and join in a struggle to learn something, comes to me the way that I came to law school originally, thinking that law meant rules. Indeed, in our common speech, we speak of the law, meaning the rule. I have a brother who is a medicine man, and he can be made fairly angry if I refer to a tablet as being medicine. And he will give me a short form lecture in which he will say, look, Vern, that is a drug or a pharmaceutical preparation. The ability to use that helpfully to resolve a physical problem is the practice of medicine. Can you get that through your thick skull? See? The tools, whether they are drugs or scalpels or bandages or whatever, plus my skill in the process of applying them after diagnosis to treat a particular problem, results in a beneficent result if things go well. That's the practice of medicine. If I can incorporate that same thought here, a rule is like the tablet. The process is the way that you decide whether or not to make an application of this rule or that rule to a given problem, and thus hopefully to work out in this systematic way a result which has social utility. One ought not really worship or deify aspirin tablets. Aspirin tablets are not good for everything. In fact, there are certain conditions where aspirin, I'm told, ought not to be used. One ought not to deify a rule. There are some circumstances in which rules ought to be used, and there are other circumstances to which that aspirin tablet, that specific rule, does not apply. And the source from which you get the aspirin tablet does not make it more or less sacred or more or less holy or more or less immutable. It's still just an aspirin tablet. And the source from which one gets a rule does not make it more or less holy, more or less sacred, more or less immutable. It's still just a rule. In creation, God made man, gave him dominance, told him to use those things which were created. One of the things that God created is food, world, wheelbarrows, aspirin tablets, and rules. I can modify wheelbarrows. I can modify food to meet my needs. I can modify aspirin tablets. I can modify rules. However, when we talk about the system of law, a way of approaching problems using those tools which we have in an appropriate process and coming out with useful results, we may very well be talking about something which is qualitatively different from simple rules alone. Thus ends the first 10 hours of jurisprudence. Now going into the second quarter, one must look at the question of what do you want law to do for you? What's its utility? If we can examine the jobs that we expect law to perform, maybe we'll know something more about its function, its nature, how it works. Well, certainly the first thing that one notices about law is that we want to settle disputes, hopefully with the least amount of violence as possible. It's a way of resolving animosities, hang-ups, misfires between human beings that otherwise are going to have to be resolved in some other way. All law process is in its nature adversarial. It can't be any other way. We describe it that way. It's the law of buyer against seller, landlord against tenant, tortfeasor against tortfeasee. All law opposes the opposite and opposing interests, the tension between persons who have come into some sort of a conflict. One can resolve conflicts in a great many different ways. Violence is perhaps the most common. As one moves away from violence, just raw brute strength, where might makes right, over to a systematic way of resolving in a workable, useful, acceptable fashion these disputes, you get closer and closer to what a lawyer sees as being the ideal operation of law. I have a friend who practices law in Seattle. He was in the Second World War in the Marine Corps, which is a pretty good organization. I happen to have been in the Air Force myself. One thing that the Marines had that was better than we had was a public relations department that was much more active. During the invasion of Iwo Jima, my friend, who was then already a lawyer, was landing on the beaches along with the rest of the troops, and the good old PR people rushed up and they stuck under his nose the prototype of a tape recorder and said to him, "Lieutenant, what are your reactions to all of this bloodshed going on around you?" And he, as a good lawyer, said, "I think this real estate question ought to be settled in the courts." And you just can't knock that, you see. If we can have a way of symbolizing or routinizing our disputes so that we can take out our hostilities and our animosities in some way which is less violent than raw violence, then every step toward this is good. So we settle disputes, and that's just the minimal, the bare, the beginning function of law. The next thing that you would ask, I suppose, of a legal system is to try and avoid disputes. Because whenever there is a dispute which goes beyond simply academic discussion or beyond an intellectual exchange about relative merits of a process or of a discovery, as soon as it gets to the place where it's disruptive and lacks utility, and that's not a very easy thing to measure, because good, vigorous discussion is a very helpful way of trying to determine the validity of a good many processes. But when it gets to the place where the heat begins to be more than useful, then you have a drag and a loss of forward motion in your society, your civilization, and you'd like to try and avoid that drain or that loss on what we would like to build collectively as a society. Out of this first function of settling disputes, the legal process has a built-in mechanism for identifying the kind of things which are giving rise to problems. For example, in the state of Washington right now, there's an unconscionable number of disputes going on about real estate contracts. I won't bore you with the details, but whenever you start getting clusterings of litigation about one kind of problem, you know that the rules are not working well anymore. And something's got to be changed, because those rules that we look to help us organize our lives are not functioning appropriately, and as a result, we're getting far too many disputes, hang-ups, loss of efficiency, and so it becomes necessary to try and avoid those disputes from the information that we have gathered. Well, how do you avoid disputes? Well, you try to give people a basis for planning. You try to tell them that if you do things in this way, these will be the consequences. Write your contract this way. Write your will this way. Write your trust instruments this way. Approach people in this way. Take out this kind of insurance policy. Plan in this way. And your perception will meet the perceptions, the anticipations of the other people in your society, and you won't have these conflicts and disputes. Therefore, you will see that it becomes extremely significant in avoiding disputes to have law which is settled. And it's predictable, it's firm, it stays the same, it doesn't move, it doesn't change. What's the use writing a 100-year lease if the law is going to change right beneath you? 5 hours, 5 days, 5 weeks, 5 months later, it's different. You cannot plan if you do not have law that goes on stable and unmoving, solid, predictable. Are you with me? Of course, at the same time, society isn't going to stand still. You get a certain amount of change going on in society all the while, and we're going to have to worry about that. And it happens at the moment that we are engaged in more active social change, probably, than mankind has ever been before. There are all kinds of reasons for that, not the least of which is that there are more of us than ever before. Something like 1 out of 5 people that ever lived in the history of the world are alive today. Somewhere between 85-95% of all the scientists who ever got around to breaking test tubes are vigorously breaking test tubes today. And the rest of us are carrying on our functions in a way that we're making an impact upon the world in which we live with a vigor that's quite unmatched in our history. As a result, we have a lot of change going on. We have to do something about a number of things that could be handled at a much more leisurely pace at an earlier time. So it's necessary to do justice for the individual in his case. And if the society has changed around him so that it's no longer fair to test him by rules of last week or last year or last century, because those rules were made for another people at another time in another circumstance, and the circumstances have now changed, then the rule is no longer applicable justly to this man. Therefore, it becomes very important that your law be easily changed. So all that you have to do to have a good system functioning here is to have something which changes routinely and works out a result for each individual in his circumstances while it remains immutable and without change. If you want to even approach that kind of thing, and obviously you can't do it with anything nearly perfection, but if you even want to approach it, you must start developing two kinds of mechanisms. One is a way of informing people what it is that you're about and the direction in which you are trending, in order that their perceptions may start building to follow this trend, so that they can predict and appreciate and understand where you're going. And the very best way of doing that, of course, is to allow people to be a party to every change of rule that's made. Every time you're going to get a new rule, I do not say process, every time you get a new rule, it's very important that to the greatest degree possible that every guy who's going to be affected by that rule should be involved in its structure, in its definition. This is why we prefer the democratic, if you want to call it that, the legislative process, the best way of involving people to the maximum degree that's feasible, OEO language. So we set up legislative bodies, and we elect persons, and they go down there, and they undertake discussions, and they represent we the people, and then we feel that our will has been expressed in our new legislation, and the rule has changed because we want to change it, and that's great. How do you do that as a practical matter? Say, for example, that you decided that you'd like to have a change with reference to, shall we say, treatment of alcoholics, to pick up where we were last night. It's a very simple thing. Inform your legislator. I have watched this operate. You would tell the legislator about it. He finally decides that there's something there. He goes down to the legislative session. He introduces a piece of paper, which never gets outside of the first committee. But that's all right. You've made a dent. 2 years later, he resurrects the piece of paper. He gets it into the committee. He gets it out of the committee. And, of course, it dies in rules. That's all right. You've made a dent. 2 years later, you take it out and introduce the piece of paper. It goes through his committee. It goes through rules. And it passes the House. It never gets to the Senate, of course. That's all right. 2 years later, you go back. Now, do you see what I'm building up here? The legislative process depends upon informing you, the people, what the problem is. If you're going to be a part of this process and you're going to be involved in it, if you're emotionally going to feel that's my rule, it's been adopted out there, your legislator must reflect you, and he stands in real horror, the public not understanding what he's doing. It's a good way not to get elected. And as a result, there is a long, hard, slow social process that has to go into legislation, which may make 10, 12, 15 years. Gee, at the time of Moses, it was great. We had 100 years to work on something. It didn't really make much difference because society wasn't changing around you anyway. Things were pretty much the same in legislation. A reflection of the people's will was great. Today, we're going to literally die in our own filth if we wait for that kind of process. We must accelerate our way of working social change. We must accelerate the rate at which we can make changes in the rules by which we govern ourselves or die. Literally. The world cannot support us in an agrarian, a simple agrarian state. If you want to go back to the noble savage and grow your own grain and grind it on your own stones and bake your own bread, we've got to get rid of roughly two-thirds of us. The alternative is to organize ourselves so that we can live in a technological society, because we live by technology today. In order for technology to work, we must have systems which are dependent upon the ability to both perceive what changes are going to occur so we feel that they are just, and we must have a system which updates that technological process to our current needs. Law is basically a conservative exercise. Judges are supposed to protect us from having our freedom impinged upon. Law in our tradition is essentially negative. In the common law, law is not a helping discipline. It does not tell you how to do things. It protects you from impingements or invasions upon your own integrity. The law says that you may swing your fist just as vigorously as you like, as long as you keep it off of my nose. It's only when your fist hits my nose that you've got a violation of law. Because the law protects me from you, it protects you from me. The whole notion of a jury is to keep the judge from getting too autocratic and arbitrary in his decisions. The function of a judge is to be sure that the jury doesn't go off half-cocked and wild. The rules of pleading are to keep extraneous matter from getting into decisions. The rules of evidence never tell you what evidence may be introduced into a case. It only tells you what you may not put in. Law is essentially an exercise of limitations and negatives. It tells you what you may not do. It does not tell you what you must do or how you ought to maximize. It creates a protected area within which you may, by your own experimentation, do your own thing and maximize your own sense of values, and by experimentation, develop what you see as being the most important and fundamental thing. Law is negative in this sense. I pause here parenthetically just to say that law can never redeem a person or create affirmatively. It can only create boxes within which one may be imaginative. Well then, how do you change? Well, there's a way of working change by changing systems. By changing, if I may say so, legal systems. That is, systems which the law recognizes. Because everything we do, we operate from a basis of systems. Let me illustrate this. One could go back a very short way into our history and think about financing in the United States. At a time when people wanted to go down and borrow some money, you went down to the bank and you mortgaged your real property and they gave you a loan. No one ever heard of mortgaging something like a piece of chattel property, a car or something of this sort, because they weren't in existence. There was no chattel, which was expensive enough so that people had to borrow money in order to buy one. You bought chattels, the simple tools and so forth, the primitive needs of a relatively primitive society out of your current income. Along came H. Ford and developed the Tin Lizzie. And people now had something to buy that cost more than they could come up with out of the jeans. And so people went down to the bank and said, I want to borrow money. And the banker said to them, what are you going to use for security? Where is your real property upon which you can place a mortgage? And the man said, I don't have any real property. And the banker said, well, how are you going to borrow the money? What's the security? And the man said, oh, I'm going to use chattel acquisition financing. And the banker said, how's that again? Because, of course, nobody had ever heard of that before. There wasn't any such thing. The fellow said, well, I'm going to let you have a mortgage on the car, at which point the banker went into gales of laughter. And because society demands mobility of our rules, when faced with a new circumstance, friendly loan companies developed. Savings and loan companies came into existence. Revolving credit plans got formalized into statutes and case decisions. And we changed our legal systems. We can do this 1,000 times over as society moves. And tomorrow morning, I'm going to be talking with you about the changes which must occur in what we call the family system, the changes which are occurring in the family system in order to recognize the realities of the life that we are leading.
One hopes out of all of this that the law can also identify for us what we might call authority, although that in itself is an extremely difficult word.
Who gets to say? Who gets to make the decision? Who is authoritative? What is authoritative? What is right? Horrible term, that, right? As I tried to tell you last night, the law says a man must be minimally intelligent in order to stand in his own defense. That is, he must know the difference, and this is the basic intelligence test. He must know the difference between right and wrong. I think he's a blasted genius if he knows the difference between right and wrong, because I struggle for it constantly and I cannot find it. It eludes me. I think perhaps I can measure things which are better and worse, more useful and less useful, because law is essentially the measuring of activity over a pattern. It's easy, for example, to measure the utility of a plumbing system or of a heating system, because there we have definitely specified objectives, and we can say so many feet with so many bends, such size pipe, such type of air motion, and it works better. That is to say, it makes you hotter, or it plugs up less frequently, or whatever your test of utility may be. But when you go beyond that and you start laying down the rules for this is the best poem in the world, then you get pretty flaky in your law. For example, the next time you have the opportunity to go to a flower show where they are judging the best gladiola in the whole place, look at the rules. What is beauty? What are the rules that govern beauty in the testing of gladiolas? You got to have a certain number of blossoms, and they must be in this order. The fact that it looks like a stick makes no difference. If it's got the right number in the right sequence, that's a beautiful flower, even though no one with eyes would ever pick it out as being best. Rules can test only utility. Law can test only utility. Well, how do you identify authority then? Well, what does law have to work with? People have to respect law. It's necessary. If we think of our own body of law as starting perhaps about the time of Moses, law antedated Moses by a long time, obviously. No group of people lived together without some kind of formalized rules and structures, some kind of law. But if we think of Moses as creating a new body of law, and he did, incidentally, there isn't any direct basis for what Moses did in his body of laws. God, I know pre-Hittite society had contract and a bunch of other things, but Moses introduced quite a new thing, quite a remarkable thing, really. It isn't Egyptian. It isn't out of one of the Mideastern cultures. It doesn't have any direct antecedents. And it sure didn't come from that bunch of louse-ridden slaves that he was keeping company with. Moses gets out there in the wilderness, check it sometime, Exodus or Numbers, either one will give you a pretty good description of what's going on. I like particularly the time when Jethro comes to Moses. It's his father-in-law. You can always trust a father-in-law or a mother-in-law. Moses sitting out there in the tent in the wilderness, and the people lined up in front, and this one's complaining about somebody pinched his camel, and the next one says somebody pinched his wife, and you go down the long line of grievances and disputes. Moses is sitting there practically knock-kneed and cross-eyed trying to answer all these disputes. And Jethro says, look, Mac, if you think you can handle all the grievances that these people are going to cook up all by yourself, you've got poles in your head. You need a jurisprudential system. Set up a body of rules and set up a court structure. And perhaps it's out of this period that we get the Sanhedrin and as well as the substantive rules of law. If Moses at this point had called a meeting and said, fellas, I'm going to go into seclusion for the next 30 days and whip out the revised code of Moses, he probably would have got stoned on the general theory of how come your sociology is so much better than mine. And it wouldn't have commanded the kind of respect or identification of authority which is necessary in order for a legal system to work. Instead of that, Moses, and I mean no disrespect, I do not mean to be sacrilegious, the guy was just a great Barnum and Bailey advocate. Moses has got mountains that smoke and rocks that shake and lines that you can't step over without dropping dead, and he goes up in the mountain. Great big fuss. When he comes down, he's got the law. And boy, you don't question it. That's the law. That's not Moses. Yeah, and this, in almost every decision that's written, I read it to you last night several times in the Powell case. Our duty, the Supreme Court says, is not to legislate. We don't make the rules. We just interpret them. We just apply them. We, the people of the United States, write into our Constitution that we are a government of law, not of men. The whole common law tradition visualizes the judge sitting up there in the woolsack, and you bring in a brand new question to him. There's nothing in the books. You see, the common law system doesn't have the civil rules of the old Holy Roman Empire. It doesn't have the code system where everything presumably was written out. Rather, you bring in a new case, and you ask the judge how's it be decided. There's nothing in the book, the rule, that says so. And he's got to decide it new. So he sits back and he rolls his eyes up into the heavens, and there he sees the law. And then he tells you the decision. And you're never going to get him to admit that he just made it up. That would be a law of a man. And he doesn't dare legislate. That's the legislative function. God gives the rules, the legislator speaks, the church speaks the rules, the substantive rules, and the judge just interprets and applies. Now, he's pretty good to be able to sit there and gaze up without the benefit of telescope or anything and pick that rule right out of the air and announce it. But it's very useful, because if you don't do that, you don't know who's in charge. And you might have people going around after a while saying, look here, is the Supreme Court of the United States really applying the law, or are they just giving us a bunch of sociological, communistic pap? It would be possible to have an erosion of people's respect for law and order. It would be conceivable in a society like ours that someday you might even see people going around putting up signs saying things like impeacher or Warren. And that's conceivable. It could happen. If people got to the place where they thought that the court was no longer speaking the pure law, but rather were injecting their own personalities into it. And what happens if you do that? You bottom out. Ladies and gentlemen, what I'm trying to tell you is that if the legislative process will not work for the critical problems of our society because it's too slow, if we can't educate the populace rapidly enough to make the adjustments that we must make in order to avoid the problems that Rosemary has just been discussing with us, if you can't preserve your cities by agreement of the population through rules in which rulemaking processes in which they are involved in a satisfactory way, then you must resort to an adjudication by the court. Every Supreme Court has gotten into some trouble with somebody. It's of the nature of things. This Supreme Court doesn't want to be in trouble any more than any other one, but it's caught in such a dynamic period in society that it can't avoid it. And as a result, the Supreme Court in the last few years has taken on almost every power block in the United States. Churches, state legislatures, the police, any power group that you can think of, if the Supreme Court's overlooked defending them, it's been by pure accident. Not because they want to. Do you understand what I'm saying? That we are caught in an accelerating, dynamic process which has thrown the court into a place where it must more and more and more frequently speak to the void which is left by the inadequacies of the legislative process. Once in the history of the United States, following the Second World War, in the Taney Court, the United States Supreme Court almost bottomed out. The great lawyer president, a man by the name of Lincoln, threw into prison without trial a colonel. The colonel got to jail and he said, I have not been tried, and it's unconstitutional to put a man in jail without trial. Habeas corpus. I want out. The traditional writs coming all the way from Runnymede, the Magna Charta. Everybody knows that I can't be put into jail. The court said, you're right, colonel. Let him out. And the president said to the jailer, keep him in. The United States Supreme Court said to the president of the United States, it is unconstitutional to imprison a man because you don't like him without trial, without having a right to stand before his peers and be found to be in violation of some rule. Let him out. And the president of the United States said, I will not. And the Supreme Court said, you must. And the president said, whose army are you going to use? And the colonel stayed in jail. And we hit the bar. You see, at this point, we became a straight dictatorship because our judicial machinery had bottomed out because we had lost, in the Dred Scott decisions and others, a willingness to let authority be identified by this process. Well, the last one, some kind of a net forward movement we'd like to get out of our legal system. Some way of moving our society forward toward some recognizable goal. And I guess this is going to be a pretty good place to stop so we can get a cup of coffee. And maybe I should make a deal with you that tomorrow morning, since I talk too much and move too slowly, it might be a good idea to start looking at what lawyers see as being some possible contesting sources of law. That is, a quick look at what might be thought of as positive law, what might be described as being natural law, what might be used to describe the kind of legal system in which, the kind of legal philosophy, jurisprudential philosophy, which we follow in the United States. And perhaps in that process, I can give you some idea of how we function actually from day to day. And if I don't get to the family until Friday morning, why, I guess I can survive if you can. All right, that'll do for this morning.